Hashtag Sisters in Law is going on tour in May. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour. You can see us live at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago on May 2nd, the Royal Oak Music Theater in Detroit on May 9th, and the Schubert Theater in Boston on May 30th. Go to politicon.com/tour to get your tickets now.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. We live in a world of lies, of social media scams, of disinformation. We're facing an election with one political party that really has adopted the tactics of strongmen, of fascists around the world, which is to bamboozle the public, to prey on emotionalism, to stir violence. And it's really a great challenge. This is not how American politics has always been, and it doesn't need to be this way. But we are where we are. And under the general rubric of disinformation, huge damage has been done to our country. We remember back in 2016, the Russians were using disinformation to pump up Donald Trump and to disparage Hillary Clinton. In 2020, Donald Trump came up with the biggest lie of them all, the big lie, which was that the election had been stolen. And he used that lie to stir millions of people to anger and thousands of people to storm the Capitol in the only attempted coup we've had and the only real failure to pass from one administration to the next without violence. So how does this disinformation take hold? Some of the lies seem so absurd on their face. Really? The election was stolen? Something about Chinese bamboo in the ballots in Arizona? That doesn't make any sense. How is it that people get so discombobulated and so willing to unlearn lies that they have imbibed? How is it that we live in an era in which it no longer seems like rational discussion, persuasion is possible? Well, we have just the person to explain this all to us. Many of you are familiar with Barb McQuaid, who is one of the sisters-in-law, who is an MSNBC analyst, who is a law professor at University of Michigan, and who's a great friend of mine. She has written a book, Attack from Within, which is exactly about disinformation, how it is sabotaging, as the subtitle goes, our democracy. And I can think of no better person and no better time to discuss all of this. So Barbara, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Jen. Great to be with you.
It is such a delight and such a delight to be here to talk about your book, which is fantastic. I think whether you set out to do so or not, I think it makes the perfect leap from academics, from a lot of social science study, from a lot of legal study, to just the ordinary American who wants to know what the heck is going on. Was that your intent to kind of do what you do on Sisters in Law and other programs to make kind of a law or a phenomenon interesting, not remedial, but easy to understand? Was that kind of the genesis of what you were looking to do?
Yes. You know, I just try to explain. That's my goal with media commentary. That's my goal as a teacher, to try to reach a general audience of, reasonably intelligent people and help try to explain, this national security threat so that people can understand it, can identify it, and can defeat it by recognizing it when they see it.
Define for our audience what disinformation is. It's not just a lie. It's not just a mistake that someone makes when they say something isn't true. What is disinformation?
Disinformation is like propaganda. It is a deliberate lie designed to deceive and manipulate other people. It's not an honest mistake. It's a deliberate strategy.
And we seem to have more of it than we used to. Is that because we have more media outlets, or is that because the political climate now is in such a state that people are more receptive and more willing to use it, frankly?
I think it's a little of both. So, you know, one on the technology side, certainly more than ever before, people have the ability to reach audiences at a speed and a scope that is unparalleled in history. You know, there was a time if you wanted to undertake a propaganda campaign, you might have to use word of mouth or leaflets or plant a story in a newspaper somewhere and hope it made its way into the mainstream population. But now, of course, someone can manufacture a lie online and send it in with the push of a button and reach millions of people all over the world. So I think that is a big part of what's driving it. But you get at another part of it, which I talk about in the book as well, which is why do people even want to say these false things? And I think that is part of what is unique in this political moment. We have become so polarized that I think it has become a political strategy to demonize your opponent, suggest there are only two sides to every issue, and the other side is the devil. It is, you know, such an untenable choice that your only choice is my side. And so it's very divisive, I think. It means that there's a demand for political purity and no room for nuance or compromise, which I think is how we actually get things done. So I think it's a combination of those two things, this win by any means necessary, choosing tribe over truth. I think, you know, we'll do anything to win. And I think that is what is driving a lot of this disinformation.
During the Cold War, I think we became accustomed to the notion of propaganda, foreign propaganda. Mm-hmm. And it reintroduced itself, of course, in 2016. But disinformation now, as you point out in the book, is much more insidious because it's us. We're doing this to ourselves. How did that come about? And why is that, in a sense, more dangerous than foreign propaganda or foreign efforts to manipulate us?
Yeah, that's where the title of the book comes in, Attack from Within. You know, this is no longer an attack from a hostile foreign adversary. I have studied national security for most of my career as a national security prosecutor, and now I teach a course on national security at Michigan Law School. And so I've seen this threat evolve from threats from the outside to now this threat from the inside. And I think it is, we are living in times when we are so determined to win that we have lost all interest in truth and integrity. And this is the way the world has worked in authoritarian regimes for a long time. It has not been the case here, where we have free speech and a marketplace of ideas, and usually the best ideas rise to the top. But that's only if people are acting in good faith. And so what we're seeing now is something that exists in Putin's Russia as well, which is this idea that there really is no truth. There are no facts. Who's the truth police? Who decides what is true and what is false? And it's really unknowable. And in fact, truth is for suckers. If all you care about is truth, then you'll never win. What matters more is which candidate is going to get more for you? Which candidate shares your worldview? And, you know, truth, that's for chumps. That's for suckers. And so voters will see this and become cynical and then eventually disengage from politics altogether, which is right where an authoritarian wants them. You know, people just throw up their hands and say, it's all so mean. It's all so deceptive. I don't know who to believe. So I'm just going to pay attention to my family and my job and maybe some celebrity gossip and maybe some stories about pets.
Well, let's not underrate stories about pets now. Let's not go too far. Now, what is also different about this phenomenon is that you have a presidential candidate and an entire political party that seems to have taken disinformation as a fully acceptable form of politics, that they've said, yeah, okay, we're in this game, very unabashed. I don't think we've ever had that phenomenon, have we?
No, and I think it comes from a place of weakness. When we had two thriving political parties, they could engage in a debate of ideas. And, you know, with one party is losing hearts and minds, it has to resort to unfair tactics. You know, it's like guerrilla warfare. The only way a smaller nation can defeat a larger nation is by engaging in guerrilla tactics, and I see that as what this is, that there is a goal. You know, there's a segment of the country that are Christian nationalists or those who fear a changing population. You know, by 2045, it is projected that the United States will be a majority-minority country. And, you know, some don't like a world where the LGBTQ community has equal rights and opportunities to other people. And so they gravitate toward people who say things like, I'm going to build a wall, or we're going to ban books that normalize the LGBTQ community or Black history. They are willing to say things like, the LGBTQ community wants to groom your children for pedophilia. I'm sure people, you know, there's probably some people who believe that's true. I'm sure there are plenty more who do not believe it's true, but are willing to engage in it in an effort to, use brute force to get their way. And, you know, one of the things I learned in my research, Jen, is that we are wired not to solve problems so much as to win arguments. And there's a pair of scientists I cite in the book who refer to this as my side bias. Yes. We all have this my side bias that once we make up our mind about something, it's very difficult for us to change our minds. We dig in, and when the more people question our decision, the more stubborn we come about it. And that goes back to days where whoever yelled the loudest, you know, got the biggest cave and the biggest piece of meat and all of those things. And so we are not so well wired to just think through logically, admit when we're wrong, and reconsider. And so I think that is what causes us to dig in into our sides, and maybe, you know, causes people to care so much about affiliating with their side, their team, that they're willing to bend the truth to get there. I see it as people choosing tribe over truth. And although I think it is the far right extreme part of the Republican Party who is most guilty of this offense, I think all of us are. We see the other side as nothing I want to be affiliated with in any way whatsoever. And so people will say things, I think they probably convince themselves that they're true, but say whatever they need to say to support their side. You know, we've had all these criminal cases, civil cases against Donald Trump, and it's amazing how everybody lines up on one side or the other, that every single issue is in favor of Trump or every single issue should go against Trump. And in fact, it's more nuanced than that, right? Some of these arguments are stronger than others, and we really should be looking at them as a case-by-case basis. But instead, I think people really look at the bottom line and then reverse engineer their reasoning to get there.
Did you know that learning actually makes a sound? No, it's not the wheels turning in your head. It's true. Listen. That's the sound of you becoming a better you by learning a new language with Babbel 2024. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app that actually works because it's designed by real people for real conversations. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Instead, have a fun learning with Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and rooted in real-life situations. Plus, they're all delivered with a conversation-based teaching method, so you'll be ready to start using what you've learned in the real world in no time at all. Right now, I'm using Babbel to learn Spanish. It's easy and so much fun. It's like playing a game on your phone. I'm already feeling more confident, and I love putting my new skills to the test. It's the perfect excuse to go to, I don't know, Cancun. But the only question is where your life is going to take you when you pick up new language skills with Babbel. Babbel even has speech recognition technology to help you improve your pronunciation and accent so you're ready to make new connections. Here's what it's like.
Adios.
Adios.
Hola.
Hola.
Adios.
Adios.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
Mucho gusto.
Mucho gusto. Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study even found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester in college. Babbel already has over 16 million subscriptions sold. And all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. And here's a special limited deal for my listeners. Right now, you get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for my listeners at babbel.com/greenroom. Again, get 55% off at babbel.com/greenroom, spelled babbel.com/greenroom. Rules and restrictions may apply, and you can find the link in the show notes. I thought that was one of the most fascinating parts of the book, and I've been interested in these phenomena as well, which are the kind of psychological mechanisms that sort of make us like Velcro, that the disinformation is going to stick. We have heard a lot about confirmation bias and what you're describing as confirmation bias. There's also just sheer repetition. Talk to us a little bit about some of these psychological devices that are really innate that make us very susceptible to this type of disinformation.
Yeah, so there are all kinds of cognitive biases. I mean, one is we are prone to conspiracies, and that is an adaptability feature that helps us to figure out patterns from things we've observed in the past. We see dark clouds gathering and we conclude that a storm is coming, and that's right. And so that's good, good for us. But it also means that we are predisposed to kind of want to find a pattern to everything, and we are less likely to think that random stuff just happens. And so if, you know, things look suspicious, we start putting it all together and assume that there must be some conspiracy there, that, you know, there's a hoax out to get Donald Trump by framing him for his alleged involvement in the with Russia in the 2016 election. You know, see, people start putting things together and assuming that there is some sort of conspiracy afoot. Confirmation bias is one you mentioned, and that is this was the best way this was described to me. I was discussing confirmation bias with somebody who said it so beautifully. She said it. It goes back to her old adage that her father used to say, that if you look for the best in everyone, you will find it. And if you look for the worst in everyone, you will find it. And that is true about confirmation bias. We tend to notice details that support our conclusions and ignore the ones that don't. And so in our own candidates, we might overlook their flaws and focus only on the things that we think are positive. Whereas for other candidates, it's just the opposite. We notice when things fit our narrative and we ignore the facts that don't. And so all of those things make us, you know, kind of easy pickings for disinformation. One of the tactics that was used by Adolf Hitler, and he described in Mein Kampf, I know you and I have discussed this before, one was repetition, you know, short, easy slogans that can be repeated over and over again so people start to hear it from multiple sources. But one is this idea of like the big lie, go big, because all of us engage in small lies from time to time, you know, maybe out of a place of kindness. We will say, you know, my sister may say to me, oh, your hair looks nice tonight. And I know she doesn't. But as Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, most of us could never imagine having the audacity to lie about something of great significance. And then we project onto others that same moral responsibility. And so if somebody is willing to come in and violate that moral code and lie big, we just can't believe it, because no one would lie about a thing like that. I mean, how could they possibly lie about something as big as a stolen election? I mean, they'd be found out. They'd lose all their lawsuits and they'd lose all their audits. Oh, yeah, they would, wouldn't they?
Exactly. You know, it is a funny thing. I just finished reading a book about an infamous forger during World War II, a Dutch painter who decided he was going to forge a Vermeer. Vermeer, as you probably know, is one of the most famous artists, very few of his paintings. Well, you look at the painting, it was not only a bad job at imitating a Vermeer, It was atrocious. It looked like a third grader had done it. And it was that principle. If he made it too close to the original, people would notice the small differences. But if you made something outlandishly different and said, oh, this is a missing link between two strains of his, you know, artistry, then you could bamboozle everyone. And he wound up bamboozling museums and Hermann Göring, of all people, who was out pillaging art in World War II. And it really struck me, having read your book, that going big, going outlandish is actually easier than making these small shadings where people might say, I'm not so sure about that. That doesn't look quite like the original I remember seeing. So going audacious, being shameless, seems to be a key to pulling this kind of stuff off.
Yeah. You know, and this is a trick con men use all the time. I talk in the book about some of the cases I prosecuted at the U.S. Attorney's Office, including a doctor who was a successful cancer doctor and lied to patients, telling them they had cancer when they did not, so that he could bill exorbitant amounts of money through chemotherapy treatments for them. And not only was it an outrageous lie, and they could not imagine anyone would lie about such a thing, nor can I to this day. It is so outrageous. It is so audacious. But when the accusations were first made, they refused to believe it because he was their trusted doctor. He could never do such a thing. That's a lie. So it took them a while to come around because, you know, again, just the stubbornness that once we've made up our mind about something, facts are difficult to persuade us. It requires a lot of showing before we're willing to change our minds.
You, as you noted at the beginning, began your career in national security. And many people may not intuitively understand why disinformation is a national security problem. Explain why it is.
So there are a couple reasons. I think one is just the public safety against domestic terrorist groups. We are seeing now, as a result of disinformation, threats and swatting and plots to attack public officials at high and low levels, because people are accusing them of engaging in misconduct. So, you know, public health boards, election boards, library boards, school boards, all of these people have been targeted just for doing their jobs, because people with disinformation who have this agenda are ginning up a lot of evil intentions to these people who are just doing their job. So I think that is a danger to our civic life and a danger to our national security. But more broadly, on an international scale, we are harming our democracy when we are trying to sow doubt in the outcome of elections. And so in 2016, when we had that group storm the Capitol and try to physically stop the certification of the vote for Joe Biden, we were on display for the rest of the world. There were people in Russia who laughed at us and said we were the laughing stock and we were no longer able to lead with moral authority on democracy because we were limping with both feet after that. You know, while we are dealing with that attack at the Capitol, we're very fortunate that we did not have an attack on our country, because it would have been difficult to defend it while everybody is focused on what's happening with our own U.S. Capitol. But one of the things that has been a part of U.S. foreign policy since World War II is the idea of promoting democracies around the world. Because when we have other democracies, it is the theory of the United States that there will be fewer wars that we'll be involved in. We have more trade partners that can increase our prosperity. And there will be fewer refugee crises around the world when people are not trying to flee oppressive regimes. And so we have spent a lot of money and effort and diplomacy trying to build up democracies all over the world. And now when people say, but you've proven that democracy is an inferior form of government because people don't accept the outcome. And so, you know, maybe some of these other forms of government are better. And, you know, we're seeing backsliding of democracy in a number of countries around the world. Are we the cause, or are we simply part of the same effect that is going on there? In China, leaders there say, democracy isn't the point. Prosperity is the point. Democracy is just a means to an end, and our means is better. Of course, they lock up protesters and reporters and things there, so I'm not sure I agree with that. But it is harmful to democracy when we have political leaders undermining public confidence in the outcome of elections.
And when you think about it, imagine a foreign power saying, ah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to spread measles throughout the state of Florida. If it works there, maybe the whole country will be affected. And yet you have the guy who is the head medical official in Florida telling people not to get inoculated from measles and therefore putting an entire population at risk. So in a sense, disinformation can result in just audacious actions that even a foreign power could never possibly achieve on its own. That seems to me not only political threat, but physical threats,
yeah.
Physical violence. That's what we saw during COVID, a whole industry dedicated to disinformation. And that seems scary.
Yeah, so in my home state of Michigan during COVID, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer had, like many states, some shutdown orders, shutting down businesses to stop the spread of the pandemic in the early days. And there were a group of men who plotted to kidnap her, exercise a citizen's arrest, and put her on trial for violating their due process rights. That's the kind of thing that happens when people get fired up by disinformation. They don't see law enforcement acting in the way they believe they should, and so they're inclined to take the law into their own hands, which is incredibly dangerous. I mean, people aren't trained to be law enforcement officials to conduct arrests. They don't know the law. And so it's what gives people like Kyle Rittenhouse or the man in Cincinnati who breached an FBI office after Donald Trump accused the FBI of planting evidence at Mar-a-Lago, or Cesar Sayoc, that pipe bomber who went after some of Trump's rivals in the media and the Democratic Party, or the man who took the hammer to Nancy Pelosi's husband. All of these people, I think, consider themselves, vigilante justice warriors because law enforcement isn't doing their job while these people are doing all of these awful things, so they've been told.
Right. And I must say, we saw you in Washington at Politics and Prose. Two doors down is Comet Pizza. And that was the location that a bunch of QAnon folks convinced their followers was the site of a Hillary Clinton-based sex abuse child running scam, and people showed up and someone got killed. That's really an unbelievable cause and effect between maybe a movement that started as some kind of political disinformation scheme, but has very real world effects. People do die. And this swatting that you talked about, this is when police come to their house with guns drawn. Is that what we're talking about here? I think.
Yeah. Swatting, usually it has the name because it attracts the SWAT team. You call, I say Jen Rubin is my target. I say there's someone at her home with a gun who's taken Jen hostage and says he won't come out alive. And so you call the police and then they see somebody walk out. Then, they assume he's this armed gunman and there is some risk there to safety. In fact, there was a swatting incident several years ago that was provoked by an argument during online gaming where a man walked outside when the SWAT team showed up and they shot him and killed him. So it's a very dangerous thing to do. And we are seeing many officials. I think Jack Smith was swatted. I think the Secretary of State of Maine, I think Judge Tanya Chutkan in Washington were all the targets of swatting. And it's a serious problem when, we have public officials going after these people online, at rallies and other places, saying that, they're the enemy of the people.
Let's talk a little bit about social media. When you have these hearings and these executives all get up there, they have a little patter that goes something like, well, we're a mirror. We just hold a mirror up to society. We just reflect what is going on out there. Why is that not true?
Yeah, I don't think that's right. I think it's because of the ability to deceive people online. So it is not an accurate reflection of what people are really saying. We know from Robert Mueller's report into the 2016 presidential election that there were Russian accounts online designed to look like American political activists. And people fell for that. So there were accounts with names like Blacktivist and United Muslims of America and Tennessee GOP and Heart of Texas. So these were groups that looked like members of the political left and right. And they would, for many, many months, post content that looked very mainstream for members of that group. And so they attracted a lot of followers because people said, oh, yeah, Blacktivist, he says a lot of interesting things that are good and I can agree with. But then as it got close to the election, Blacktivist started saying things like, you know, Hillary Clinton has never done anything for us and we shouldn't do anything for Hillary Clinton. We should stay home. She is ignoring us. She is taking us for granted. Let's send her a message by staying home. And you'll never know how many people heeded that advice. But as long as some of them did, there were, you know, thousands of these accounts with these fake names trying to appear to be people they were not. And so in that way, I don't think it's fair to say they're just holding up a mirror to the rest of us. You know, some of us are reflected there, but there are also all of these anonymous accounts, some run by Russians, some run by American political operatives. And then there are these bots, which are AI-generated robots that will amplify messages. So if I put out a message that is you know, based fully on lies, and then I get a bunch of bots to amplify it, it may look like my message is much more popular than it really is. And so it starts showing up in other people's feeds, and people think, oh, this must be true. I'm hearing this everywhere.
We've also learned a lot about algorithms and how they not only help self-select information, reinforcing confirmation bias, but they make people more and more radical. Talk to us a little bit about how that works and whether that phenomenon can be regulated. There's a lot of talk about the First Amendment, about whether the Supreme Court just heard a case, frankly, mm-hmm. about whether mm-hmm. social media can be regulated. How do the algorithms play out in disinformation? And is there something that we can do about it?
Yeah, you know, the algorithms first landed on my radar screen when Francis Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, revealed some of the techniques that Facebook was using. She testified before Congress that Facebook was generating algorithms. You know, this is just computer code that tells the feeds what to do. And it was in an effort to improve engagement, which is their term, it would direct you to content designed to provoke outrage. And so they started using these emojis that were like dislike and hate. It wasn't just like and love. It added dislike and hate. And the ones that you said hate would go to the top of everybody else's feeds. And so it's what got people arguing with each other, even though you might be arguing with a bot. But people would stay online. And the longer they stayed online, the more eyeballs look at ads and the more ad revenue the platforms make. So it's in their financial self-interest to do that. But it is divisive to deliberately send these things to people in an effort to generate outrage. And I do think there are things that can be done. I think this is actually one of the areas of low-hanging fruit for regulation because it's difficult to regulate content. Content is protected by the First Amendment. And so it's not impossible, but it's much harder to regulate content. But with algorithms, this is just computer code that these companies are using to try to manipulate people. And so we could prohibit certain kinds of algorithms, you know, algorithms designed to generate outrage, or at least require disclosure of what the algorithms do so that if we're being manipulated, at least we know that. The other thing these algorithms can do, Jen, is they can micro-target people. You know, they might know that I am a 59-year-old woman who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with a fondness for sports memorabilia, and, you know, send stuff, targeted my way, sliced very, very thin. So I see those things. And we don't see what other people see. And so it makes it easy for us to be exploited. So again, if it would just be revealed to us what is in those algorithms and how we're being micro-targeted, you know, they often say, if you don't know what the product is, it's probably you. It would help us understand how we are being transformed into the product.
And I think a number of people, including the Facebook whistleblower and other people who followed on, have advocated that you need to open this up to researchers. Because if researchers can really study these, they can make clear exactly how this works, exactly how much currency these sorts of things get, exactly how the algorithms work. Right now, it's kind of a black box. Facebook knows what it does. Twitter, I guess it's called X now, knows what it does, but the rest of us don't.
Yeah.
And so they kind of use this as a defense. They say, well, you can't prove this does all these things. Well, we can't prove it because you really won't open yourself up to any kind of objective analysis. So it really does become a self-reinforcing problem.
Yeah. And, you know, if they can't regulate themselves, then I think we need collectively to come up with some common sense regulations that will allow us to do that.
There are a great number of people, millions of Americans, and it really hasn't changed much since January 6, 2001, who believe something that is absolutely false, that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Once this disinformation sets in, is there any way, people sometimes analogize it to, you know, deprogramming people like from a cult. Is there any way to get these people to reconsider, or is it a matter of finding the people who are still persuadable to outvote them? What do you do by people who have been swimming in this sea of disinformation?
Yeah, there may be some people who are just too far gone, who are never going to change their mind. You know, all the things, the cognitive biases that we talked about and the stubbornness. I'm sure there are some people who will never, ever change their mind. You know, you could demonstrate that the emperor has no clothes. He could literally shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose some voters. I think that's true. But I do think there are some people who are persuadable. I cited in my book a study that Joyce Vance cited in one of her Substack newsletters. And if you're not listening to Joyce Vance's Civil Discourse Substack, you're not doing it right. It is a newsletter. It's excellent. And in it, she cited a study that said that a group of people who considered themselves regular viewers of Fox News were surveyed about a number of questions. And then for like 2 weeks, they couldn't watch Fox News, and they were subjected to lots of different news sources to learn, you know, more widespread about what was in the news. And at the end of those 2 weeks, they took the surveys again and asked their opinions on things, and they had moved. They had reconsidered things because they had heard stories they'd never heard covered before. You know, so much of what is done in terms of coverage isn't necessarily lies, but selective inclusion or exclusion of what's covered. And so if people never hear about something, they don't even know about it. I recall a time when a congressman from West Michigan had a town hall where he shared with the constituents in his community the findings of the Mueller report. And, you know, this is a town hall. These are people who show up at a political event. You'd expect them to be reasonably engaged. And he said afterwards, he talked to some woman who said, I can't believe all the stuff you told us is in the Mueller report. I mean, all I ever heard is that it was a complete exoneration for Donald Trump. So, you know, she was willing to listen, but she had always been surrounded by people who were like-minded. So she had never even heard that, you know, some of the facts that are actually in that Mueller report.
And that brings us to the greater problem of addressing, combating disinformation. I love, again, this is one of the great parts about the book, is you give sort of categories. There are things government can do, there are things that large organizations there can do, and there are things that ordinary people can do. Talk to us a little bit about some of those things, both on an individual level and a larger societal level.
Yeah, well, we already talked about some of the regulations for algorithms, but I think there are other things we can do. You know, one is we are stuck with this Supreme Court opinion called Citizens United. And I know we've talked about this one before. That's the one, of course, where the Supreme Court said that corporations and other organizations and labor unions have First Amendment rights. And so their spending limits on candidates, ads for candidates, cannot be restricted, is the holding of that case. So we might not be able to change that, but we could require disclosure of who's behind all those ads, because it really opened the floodgates of dark money and these super PACs with names like the Red, White, and Blue Grandmothers of America, when in fact it's just some sort of special interest that wants to, you know, lobby for gun rights or something. And so if we could see who's really behind some of these super PACs, I think that would be helpful to dispelling, you know, their false personas and who they really are. So I think that's something we could do at the governmental level. I think at the individual level, there is a lot we can do. And I don't like to impose the whole burden on, you know, the people, on individuals, because I think big tech has a role to play, as we've discussed, with regulation of algorithms. But I think there are things we can do. We can learn media literacy. There are media literacy classes in Finland that all school children take now because of their decades of disinformation that they've received from Russia. And so they teach students things like, don't always just read the headline and assume that's what the story says, because sometimes the headline is different from the story. Or they might say, make sure you always get a second source and don't just rely on the first source because it might not be right. Or they might say, if there's a data set, a study, how big was the data? Was it 3 million subjects or was it 3? Because that can make a big difference. And so I think that sort of critical studies can be very important. And I also think in the United States, we really need to get back to civics education. It has gone by the wayside in a number of schools, you know, as we are constantly always adding things on to what teachers have to teach their students, including teaching to these standardized tests. Things fall off that they don't have time to get to. And unfortunately, civics has been one of those things that has fallen off. But I think it is critically important that young people learn about our government and how it works, because I think you're far less likely to fall prey to manipulation if you understand how the system is supposed to work.
Exactly. And when Donald Trump says things like, oh, Article 2 of the Constitution lets me do anything I want. Yeah. If you've had some civics education, you could say, that doesn't really sound familiar to me.
Yeah, I don't remember that one. I must have been absent that day.
And you would hope that once people learn that, oh, that was a big thing, he's not telling the truth, that they would then develop perhaps more critical analysis of other things that he is saying, because those things, you know, may not be true either. One of the, I think, the frustrations that I have, and as you know, I work for a mainstream media outlet. It is not immune to this problem. I think disinformation is really hard for kind of classically trained, if you will, journalists who grew up in a world like you and I did, where there were two political parties. They had good candidates and bad candidates. Both parties had, you know, good ideas and bad ideas. Mm-hmm. And the normal story would be the Republican Party today introduced X. The Democratic Party said X was unhelpful. They cited this evidence. The Republican Party responded Y. And that would be what they would call like a balanced news story. That doesn't really work when one side is out there just making stuff up and saying bizarro stuff. Have you kind of talked directly to major news outlets, to reporters and others, to maybe get a better understanding of how they can not give up neutrality, but do better at communicating the truth when one side is in the disinformation business?
Yeah, I agree with that. That I think that traditional media, you know, these reporters grew up in a time when they could presume good faith that people might disagree, but that they were relying on the same facts and they weren't just making up the facts. Dan Rather actually has been doing a lot of work in this space, and it is his view that rather than silence voices of lies, it is important to call them out and to report out about the disinformation and to call them lies when they're lies, not candy coat it with other phrases. This is a lie. Here's how we know. These are the facts. That is not what this person said. And so to do really rigorous fact checking in real time so that everybody can see for themselves that this person is engaging in a lie, because to ignore them doesn't really solve the problem. You know, if Donald Trump is at a rally saying all kinds of outrageous things, his followers are going to hear that. Fox News viewers are going to hear that. But if, you know, MSNBC, where we work, or CNN does not cover that rally, then, you know, other ordinary American people who are not his supporters will never know the outrageous things that he is saying. And then to say, oh, yeah, he had a rally last night, and he's running for president. But to hear some of the things he's saying, I think, is really important. But what they should do is to fact check in real time. You know, you can always put down in the graphics and say this conflicts, you know, greatest economy in the history of the country. You know, actually, here's how it ranks, you know, not so much. And I think that could be helpful. It's probably difficult to keep up with him in real time because he does spew so many false things per second. But I think with some of the big things, that would be the way I would suggest doing it. And that's not an independent thought. That's the way Dan Rather says he would do it.
And Margaret Sullivan, who is a great media analyst and critic, has another bit of advice, which she calls the truth sandwich, One of the difficulties is putting the lie in the headline or putting the lie in the lead, meaning the opening statement, because that tends to kind of just give air to it. And frankly, that's all some people get to read. The way she says to do it is to say, today, Donald Trump said something that wasn't true. You then put in the thing that wasn't true. Uh-huh. And then the other half of the sandwich is, here's why we know it's not true.
Oh, that's great. The truth sandwich. I love it.
So
make mine a double.
Yeah, exactly. right on rye. But it's very difficult. And you raise a great point about Donald Trump. You know, there are blocks of what he is saying that are completely really incomprehensible. He's making statements referring to whales and craziness, and he has these kind of slurred words. And I think there's a compulsion for people in the mainstream media to kind of try to make sense of that. You know, you can't really put that down in a newspaper piece because it sounds completely crazy. So they say things like, Donald Trump made the argument today in favor of X. That's not what he did.
Yeah.
So you really do, I think, have to balance this kind of truth-telling transparency mm-hmm. with some, you know, rebuttal. I'm very curious, after you went through this whole process, because it required a lot of interesting research, I'm sure, in a lot of different areas, historical research, yeah. scientific research. Was there something about this whole process that really surprised you, that changed your view of how you look at disinformation, you look at the problem? Did you get any, you know, insights that might carry over to other areas, either from social science or from the national security perspective that you kind of picked up along the way?
Yeah, I think the thing that was most surprising to me is reading about how these same tricks were used by authoritarians like Hitler and Mussolini. It's really eerie to hear some of the things that Donald Trump says and the parallels to earlier points in history. You know, this idea of normalizing violence and talking about, you know, I'd like to go beat up those reporters, and, you know, the funny little graphics he sends where he's a locomotive crashing into reporters that, you know, is supposed to be funny, but it really is all about normalizing violence so that it is no longer a taboo for us. It's no longer unimaginable. We can think about it. That really was interesting. Another is this idea of undermining critics. So we saw this with Hitler. We saw it with Donald Trump. The idea that I'm going to call the press the enemy of the people, so that when they inevitably criticize me, I've already undermined their credibility in the public. They know that they're just the enemy. And so, of course, they're going to say bad things about me. The same is true with regard to career public servants, referring to them as the deep state, so that when they rein Trump in and say, no, you can't do that, this is how we do things in government, you know, he can just point them out as unelected bureaucrats, that they're bad people somehow and not in touch or accountable to the American people. All of these things are, you know, institutions that protect our democracy. And this effort to destabilize them, to undermine their credibility, I think, is what creates openings for a leader to come in and say, it's all broken and only I can fix it. So let me fix it for you. And people say, yeah, you're right. The ends justify the means. I mean, we don't need, you know, Trump posted that thing that said something like, you know, when a great election is stolen, it's time to, you know, solve the problem by any means necessary, even if that means repealing the Constitution or words to that effect. I mean, that's horrifying. But every time he puts that out there, it becomes a little more normal and a little less bizarre. So what was surprising to me was to see how these are the very same tactics that were used by strongmen throughout history, and Donald Trump continues to use them.
One of the ways that disinformation works is it finds people who are already used to using weapons or already think of themselves as super patriots. And so when you saw on January 6th, a shocking number of people who were there were in law enforcement or they had a military background. Yeah. You know, going back to your law enforcement background, How do you begin to address that problem within the ranks of the military and law enforcement without invading people's constitutional rights? You don't want to say anyone who voted for Donald Trump can't be in the military. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But how do you kind of address that problem of radicalization, propaganda, disinformation within law enforcement and within the military that are supposed to be protecting us from malign forces?
Yeah, it's a really hard job. And as you said, we do know that there were a number of police officers and military members who were there on January 6th to take back their country, so they believed. I think you have to focus on conduct and not philosophy or support of any political candidate, because that is a violation of the First Amendment, both the right of speech and the right of free assembly. And so the mere fact that somebody voted for Donald Trump or even said the election was stolen, I think, is not enough. But when they engage in illegal activity, I think you can take a hard line on them. Even if you can't prove guilt in a case beyond a reasonable doubt, you can fire them, you can discipline them, you can terminate them, you can do a lot of things, suspend them, short of criminal prosecution. So, you know, certainly showing up on January 6th is one. Engaging in threatening behavior would be another. You know, anything that makes that person someone who's bringing calm to a situation but is ginning up more chaos, I think is somebody that you might want to stop, regardless of their reason. They are disrupting their police force or their military that needs to be at readiness at all times.
You have been on a nationwide book tour, and you've been sharing with your followers pictures and restaurant and coffee requests and the rest. How has this experience been for you traveling across the United States? I'm really interested to see kind of what your impressions have been and what just the experience of meeting people from all different parts of the country has been like.
It's actually been wonderful. One is I've been really pleased to see how on social media most of the responses to my requests have been very positive. Not all of them. There's still, you know, there are a few trolls out there who say mean things, but mostly, you know, when I say, "Hey, I'm in Seattle. What's the best coffee place?" People send a lot of, you know, good coffee suggestions. So it has kind of renewed my confidence in good people out there who just want to help, you know, for with nothing in it to gain whatsoever. They might say, "Oh, try this coffee shop. I really like their coffee. I really like their, you know, their double cappuccino. Order the, you know, the roasted French," you know, all kinds of things like that. So it's been really nice. Also at the events themselves, when people come out, I am finding people very curious about disinformation, wanting to understand more about it, wanting to understand how to build resilience against it. And that gives me a lot of hope. I think in this election season, we are going to see a lot of efforts to confuse people, to suppress the right to vote. And there are all these great people who want to know, what can I do to help? What can I do to push back against this? So I think that's been great.
Well, hopefully the book will continue to sell out all over. You had a huge crowd, an overflow crowd in Washington, D.C., and I know you are selling a lot of books. And hopefully you'll continue on this. I think this makes a great platform for school curriculum, for public education, and hopefully you're a good spokesman for some of the reforms and the ideas you've suggested.
That's great. Thank you, Jen. Hope so.
It was an absolute pleasure being here. Good luck with the rest of your book sales, Barb. And thank you. It was a great book. Great read.
Thanks so much.
And that was Barb McQuay. Wow. She did not disappoint. She really does give us a encyclopedic view of the forms of disinformation and the things we can do about disinformation. One of the things that really makes the disinformation problem even worse, of course, is the siloed media that we live in. One of the major sources of disinformation is the most watched cable news network, which is Fox News. Now, I don't say that as a pejorative. I say that as fact. They have been found liable, and they were forced to settle a lawsuit of over $700 million based upon this lie that Dominion Systems, which is a voting software company, essentially, or voting hardware company, essentially moved votes from Joe Biden, from Donald Trump, rather, to Joe Biden. That was just a flat-out lie. Turned out it was defamation. And Fox News had to pony up. But the sad reality is, after that, they didn't stop lying to people. They didn't stop manufacturing scandals involving Joe Biden. They didn't stop, for example, talking about a made-up impeachment scandal, which has been thoroughly debunked because it came from a Russian who was in cahoots with Russian intelligence. Someone did an analysis that they've spent something like 200 hours talking about this. And yet, once it comes out that this is fraud, they don't go back and say, you know, we've all been defrauded. This is really not true. They just kind of move on. And one of the problems of disinformation is that there's very little accountability with some websites, some news outlets, some cable news stations. And that there is so much information, as Barb says, you don't know what to believe. And I'll close with this. People often ask me, how do you really find out what's going on? And believe me, I understand this is my job to figure out what's going on. And the amount of information on a daily, on a weekly basis, the amount of stuff to read is enormous, particularly if, like I, you're interested in not just what somebody else reported, but looking yourselves, watching hearings, looking at scientific studies, talking to experts in the field. That is a huge undertaking. So what do you do? How do you keep yourself informed and keep yourself on your toes so that you're not a victim of disinformation? And the best advice I can have is really threefold. First, stay off social media, except for watching this program, listening to this program, reading my posts, because those will help inform you. But in all seriousness, we spend way too much time on social media, which either confirms what we know, makes us mad about what we think is going on, or is just nonsense. So limit your social media diet. Be more discriminating in how much time and what you view. The second is find 3 to 5 really good sources of news that you routinely can check and can kind of do a gut check with. It may be a national newspaper. It may be an excellent news magazine. And don't ignore foreign news outlets like The Economist, like The Times of Israel, for example, for Middle East news. It may be a particular columnist, Ron Brownstein, who works for Atlantic and also for CNN, is a superb, straight, down-the-middle analyst who has interesting data, who has sharp analysis, who's not in anyone's pocket, who's not generating propaganda for one side or the other. Find those types of sources that can keep you abreast of the news, give you enough information, and then if you have a particular interest in some subject, sure, you can go read about climate change, or you can go listen to a podcast about disinformation, for example. But keep yourself on a steady, limited diet of smart news outlets. And the last thing I'll say is reading the news, scrolling through social media, is not an activity in support of democracy. It's a predicate. It's a requirement that you be informed, but it doesn't change votes. What changes votes is you voting, is you helping other people understand what's going on. It's you using your platform. It's you getting people registered, making sure they show up at the polls, volunteering on campaigns, volunteering to be a poll watcher. Action is critical. So if you're concerned about the election, in other words, if you have a thinking brain, you should be concerned about this election and you should be doing all of those things. So hopefully this gave you a little bit of an insight into the disinformation problem, I really urge you to get Barb's book. It's entirely readable, entirely accessible, very interesting. And hopefully you'll also continue to come back to this program. If you enjoy it, please tell your friends. They can listen, they can watch the videos, they can find us, Jen Rubin's Green Room, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.